The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated January 17/January 24, 2022. It features Shonda Rhimes' portrait on the cover. She's a woman of color with lots of black curly hair, approximately shoulder length. She's smiling at the camera with pink tinted lips and dark brown eyes. She wears a black turtleneck with a large pendant that looks pretty sparkly and glitzy. It's has a fancy S on it, which could also be a musical staff symbol. The border is outlined, as usual, in red with a smaller inner narrow margin in white. Time is superimposed in large black capital letters upon a red background behind that portrait of Shonda Rhimes. Beginning then with the view, taking on climate change in 2022. The environmental crisis we are facing can seem insurmountable. It is true we are falling behind in adapting to reality, and the window of opportunity is closing. But it's also not too late. We just need to take concrete and immediate steps forward. To that end, we have asked industry and government leaders from around the world to share their thoughts on the 2022 goals that will help us avoid climate catastrophe. Every investor must vote. This is by Christopher James, who's founder and executive chairman of investment firm Engine Number One. In 2022, investors who want to address climate change should focus on one simple but essential goal: active stock ownership. They should engage with companies on both sides of the energy transition, those heading in the right direction and those falling woefully short, and move away from blame and toward responsibility. Engine Number One spent the first 6 months of 2021 in a fiercely contested proxy battle with ExxonMobil, trying to place four new members with industry expertise and experience in transitioning away from fossil fuels on a board lacking in both. We were successful in winning three of those seats, and the company's behavior has begun to change. Before we launched our campaign, Exxon was aiming to increase oil production from 3.7 million barrels per day to 5 million by 2025. Once our campaign was underway, Exxon announced it would instead keep production flat at 3.7 million barrels per day. That 1.3 million reduction means there will be roughly 220 million metric tons fewer carbon emissions annually. Exxon barely mentioned the word carbon before we started our campaign, but it has since launched a low-carbon solutions business and is investing more in decarbonization. Recently, it announced a more ambitious target for reducing company-wide greenhouse gas emissions intensity by 20% to 30% by 2030. The company still has a long way to go. To succeed over the long term, every energy company needs a strategy for transitioning away from fossil fuels, and Exxon has yet to articulate one. But the company's behavior has started to reverse, and we are confident that had we not engaged with Exxon a year ago, the changes we have witnessed so far would not have happened. So the goal for 2022 should be active ownership, and it should not be limited to large or professional investors. Now more than ever, retail investors are interested in engaging on issues they care about. But many of those investors do not realize they have a vote on issues that can be related to companies' environmental and social impacts, or the way those companies are managed. Anyone who owns even a single share of stock in some ways owns that company. Every spring, they can vote on proposals that can range from a company's environmental policies to important management policies, such as executive pay and board composition. Just as voters in political elections change the direction of countries, shareholders have the ability to push the direction of the companies they own, but they must vote. Historically, the way investors tried to change a company's bad climate impact behavior was to divest their holdings as a show of discontent. Divestment was an important early step in bringing awareness to the negative effects that companies can have. But the idea that simply walking away will help solve the problem is misguided. If every investor who cared about moving away from fossil fuels and addressing climate change divested from Exxon to show their disdain for the company and its approach, it would simply leave the company with shareholders who do not particularly care, and that would be a problem. It certainly would have doomed our effort to place new members on the board. In 2022, investors, big and small, should make it their goal to vote this proxy season on all environmental, social, and governance issues raised at the annual meetings of companies they own. As investors, they have a seat at the table. They should sharpen their elbows and raise their voices. Hold polluting countries accountable. This is by Sorongal S. Whips, Jr. Whips is president of the Republic of Palau. Typically, much of the climate change discussion refers to it as a threat. But the reality is, for many on Earth, the crisis is already here. Many small island developing states have already suffered climate-related losses of livelihood, security, and welfare. My country, Palau, that's P-A-L-A-U, has been ravaged by the climate crisis, suffering two major typhoons that resulted in a loss of more than half of our national GDP. Our lives have been engulfed by sea level rise for two decades. King tides habitually flow into our homes. Mudslides are common along the only road to our hospital and main business center during increasingly frequent and intense storms. It is only a matter of time before a typhoon floods the corridors of our only hospital, wreaking havoc on our already strained public health system. These once seasonal occurrences now exacerbate our existing health, environment, and economic crises. On the world stage, we and those suffering similar realities have demanded bold action and robust delivery of community-centric adaptation and mitigation. Yet the voices of these indigenous peoples are drowned out as though by the winds and rains that pummel their shores. That is despite the fact that Pacific small island nation states combined are responsible for a mere 0.03% of global emissions. Meanwhile, powerful economies continue to discharge poisonous emissions, along with unfulfilled pledges to fund losses and damages. Sadly, international platforms like COP26 have been feeble sounding boards, resulting in promises leading to disappointment and false solutions that dilute the problems. The injustice is that the largest emitters are not held accountable for our plight. Given this dilemma, Palau has joined the Commission of Small Island States, COSIS, on climate change and international law to seek justice that advances the basic principle that the polluter must pay. COSIS aims to be the first to bring a case of this kind to the UN International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea. We hope our case will help determine the obligations of countries under international law and hold polluters accountable. Palau was the first member of COSIS from the Alliance of Small Island States. Following our work at the UN General Assembly and COP26, in 2022 we hope to bring in all small island countries in pursuing judicial action through international courts. This will be a priority at the Our Ocean Conference, which Palau will host in April. Like schools of surgeon fish that unite in the face of an imminent threat, the global community must come together in vision, voice, and action to combat the alarming realities of the climate crisis. Allies must hasten their stride into a persuasive march toward real progress on the reduction of emissions and prompt delivery of climate financing. Palau's people are resilient. Until the world corrects its course, we will continue to adapt one day at a time. We will mobilize our scarce resources to move our hospital to higher ground, clear the debris, and repair our homes and businesses after each coming storm, and continue to collaborate with partners and allies to collectively address future adversities. I and other Pacific leaders look to our culture and environment for wisdom to withstand these uncertain times. Yet we know wisdom without capacity cannot save us. Palau joins other small island states and indigenous peoples across the globe in calling on the international community to make 2022 a year of accountability, reciprocity, and significant investments in adequate safeguards that ensure basic human rights for the world, enabling us to fulfill our responsibility as custodians of the earth to transfer our lands, our ocean, and our cultures to future generations. Connect Hard to Reach Places to Solar Power by Nicole Poindexter. You bring your feverish baby to the hospital in the middle of the night. The nurse asks you to go home to get a flashlight. When the flashlight batteries give out, she resorts to a flickering candle to guide the insertion of an IV needle, delivering malaria medicine into your baby's hand. Maybe you don't have a baby. Maybe you travel 14 miles a day by public bus to buy fresh fish to sell in your village. Every day you must sell the fish before your ice melts and your inventory becomes worthless. In much of Africa, this is the norm. Almost half the continent's 1.3 billion population live without electricity, which destroys opportunities for education, jobs, and adequate medical care. That is why the UN has set the global goal of providing electricity by 2030 to 600 million people who are currently without it. Achieving that target will require the participation of a range of players, large organizations like the Rockefeller Foundation, development institutions like the World Bank, the governments of African countries, the entrepreneurial mini-grid utility companies like Energy City. Together, building on successes of recent years, we should aim to provide 6 million additional people with sustainable electricity in 2022, to put us on a pathway to reaching 600 million by 2030. To do so, all participants need to embrace new strategies over the next 12 months. The results of fossil fuel-based, centralized power plant strategies of the past 50 years speak for themselves. High levels of pollution and slow rollouts due to high construction and fuel costs. Instead, we need to focus on mini-grid-based electricity, powered by solar power and batteries, which can provide 24-hour clean energy. And because they're decentralized, with the electricity that each community needs provided by solar farms in the area, optimized through artificial intelligence and Internet of Things technologies. And without long, expensive transmission lines, mini-grids are often low-cost and deployable in weeks. Already, Energy City has brought solar-powered electricity to 40,000 people, and our goal for 2022 is to reach 250,000 more across four countries in West Africa. With over $10 billion committed, including pledges from organizations like the Rockefeller Foundation and from a multitude of governments, bringing green power to 6 million people in 2022 should be achievable. We have some successful models already, like a private-public partnership in Sierra Leone, mini-grid companies Energy City, Winch Energy and PowerGen, the UK Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office, and private investors providing equity funding. Together, we expect to bring mini-grid-based power to 10% of Sierra Leone's population in the next 12 months. One of Energy City's customers in Sierra Leone is Memenatu, a businesswoman living in the fishing town of Kichom. Without electricity to power a freezer, she bought fish to dry in the sun so that it would keep as she traveled the 25 miles to sell in Kambia, the district capital. Knowing she did not have enough time to dry many fish in the sun before they spoiled, she bought only 20 at a time. And because dried fish did not sell for very much, she made only about $20 on market days. After she got connected to Energy City's solar mini-grid, though, Memenatu could afford to buy and power a freezer. And as a result, her family's income has increased by some 700%. The frozen fish are much more valuable in the market than dried fish, and she can buy many more each day because freezing is faster than drying. There are millions like her for whom there is a clear solution forward, one that brings needed access to electricity to those who lack it, while building up infrastructure that will help reduce human contributions to global climate change. We just need everyone involved, from foundations to climate consultants, to national governments to private investors, to not only commit to the distributed solar energy approach, but also in 2022 to act on it. Nicole Poindexter is founder and CEO of Energy City Corp. Incentivize electric car purchases by Christina Bu. And that's B-U. Bu is Secretary General of the Norwegian EV Association. Norway's not the most likely place to start a transportation revolution, but electric vehicles, EV, are suddenly the new normal here. Almost 65% of new passenger cars sold in Norway in 2021 were electric. In addition, 22% were plug-in hybrids. It took us only 10 years to go from 1% to 65%, and this year I believe we will pass 80%. The U.S. and other governments should use 2022 to enact policies that incentivize a similar shift. How did Norway become the world's top-selling EV market per capita? Strong demand-side policies kept in place for a long time. Most cars are purchased second-hand, and people in the second-hand market rely on the choices of new car buyers. The government, therefore, taxes the sales of new polluting cars heavily, but does not tax EVs at all, making EVs, which are more expensive to produce, a competitive option. The Parliament has also decided that all sales of new cars and vans shall be zero emission by 2025. Norway's progress has been helped by emission restrictions directed at car manufacturers internationally, and we've seen the start of a global rollout of charging infrastructure. Did you see the final Super Bowl ad from GM? Will Ferrell said that he hated Norway because of the high uptake of EVs and that GM and the U.S. would catch up. And the U.S. has started. President Biden's infrastructure law includes $7.5 billion for a nationwide charging network. But the U.S. can go further, as can other countries, and implement policies directed at the demand side. The key is to start taxing new sales of at least the most polluting cars and use this money to subsidize EVs. This is a fair way to implement climate policies, as it is aimed at people buying new cars rather than an indiscriminate tax at the pump. To be clear, Norway's other incentives, like lower road tolls and cheaper public parking for those who drive EVs, also help. But tax policies on purchases are the most important step countries can take. Yes, the switch to EVs might be more politically difficult in some countries than others, but several, like Sweden and New Zealand, have already seen good results after implementing EV tax policies. And while Norway took 2.5 years to move from 2% to 10% EV market share, the UK took 1.5% and Germany only 1%. This year, all governments should join the 38 countries that signed the COP26 declaration to work toward 100% sales of new cars and vans being zero emission globally by 2040 and by no later than 2035 in leading markets. Frankly, I do not think any manufacturer will produce cars with internal combustion engines after 2035. But we are in a hurry when it comes to cutting emissions. So when there are alternatives that are more than good enough, why not speed things up? The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. The top global crisis points for 2022. A domestic focus for both the U.S. and Chinese governments lowers the odds of a big international conflict in 2022, but it leaves less potential leadership and coordination to respond to emerging crises. That's bad news in a year that will be dominated by the COVID-19 pandemic, climate change, and a number of regional geopolitical crises. One, no zero COVID. We're done with the pandemic, but it's not done with us. And the finish line depends on where you live. Critically, China's zero COVID policy will fail. In the developed world, the end is near. The highly transmissible Omicron variant is colliding with highly vaccinated populations that are bolstered by highly effective mRNA vaccines and COVID-19 treatments. That is why the pandemic will likely become endemic for advanced industrial economies in the first half of this year. But China, the primary engine for global growth, will face highly transmissible COVID-19 variants without the most effective vaccines and with far fewer people protected by previous infection. China's policy will fail to contain infections, lead to larger outbreaks, and require more severe lockdowns. That means greater economic disruptions, lower consumption, and a more dissatisfied population at odds with the triumphalist China defeated COVID of the state-run media. Two, technopolar world. Today, the world's biggest tech firms decide much of what we see and hear. They determine our economic opportunities and shape our opinions on important subjects. EU, U.S., and Chinese policymakers will all tighten tech regulation this year, but that will not limit tech giants' ability to invest in the digital sphere, where they not governments, remain the primary architects, actors, and enforcers. Tech giants cannot yet, and do not want to, effectively govern the digital space or the tools they are creating. Disinformation will further undermine public faith in democracy, particularly in the U.S. 3. U.S. midterms. In November, Republicans will almost certainly win back majority control of the House of Representatives and maybe the Senate. If so, Democrats will view GOP control as the illegitimate result of a voter suppression campaign, and Republicans will see a 2022 win as proof 2020 was fraudulent. Impeaching President Joe Biden will lead the GOP agenda, and public trust in American political institutions will take an even larger hit. 4. China at home. An increasingly burdensome zero-COVID policy and President Xi Jinping's reform plans will unsettle markets and companies in 2022. Xi's vision of technological self-sufficiency, economic security, and social harmony will collide with intensifying pushback from the West. An exhausted growth model, an over-leveraged and unbalanced economy, and a rapidly aging population. 5. A buildup of Russian troops near Ukraine has opened a broader confrontation over Europe's security architecture. President Vladimir Putin could send in troops and annex the occupied Donbas, though his current demand is for major NATO security concessions and a promise of no further eastward expansion. But a grand bargain is unlikely. Iran, 6. Iran's nuclear program is rapidly advancing. With diplomacy stalled, the Biden administration has few options. Israel will increasingly take matters into its own hands, which once again raises the specter of Israeli strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. These pressures will collide this year, leaving oil prices and regional states jittery and increasing the risk of conflict. There's a photograph in the corner of this page of column. It's captioned, Ukrainian troops on the front line with Russia-backed separatists in Donetsk, December 18. Two soldiers in camouflage gear with helmets, some type of firearms, long guns, other kinds of backpacks, front and back, a vest, perhaps bulletproof. It looks like they're standing between two haystacks. Because I see grasses just kind of sprouting out everywhere. But I think it's actually a trench with the grasses still intact on the top and about a third of the way down, because I see a ladder or a portion of a ladder, a wooden ladder, that probably reaches the floor of this trench and goes up to the top of the haystack, essentially. The View Inbox, the D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. No one really disputes the concept of political coattails. The biggest name on a ballot has some dragging fabric that can pull down-ballot contenders across the finish line. Well, it may turn out the favor goes both ways, and hyper-local candidates can have a positive spillover on their colleagues up ticket. In an analysis of 7 must-win states from Democratic Data Nerds, it turns out that fielding down-ballot races has a statistically significant effect on boosting the headliners. In other words, having someone on the ballot for parochial races like school board can actually help the contenders for governor, senator, and even president. How much help they offer varies, from 0.4 percentage points to 2.3 percentage points, according to the Blue Labs analysis, funded by Run for Something and For Our Future, two groups that emerged from the ashes of 2016's Democratic losses. A fraction of a percentage point might seem small, and it is. But Joe Biden won Pennsylvania and Georgia by 0.2 points, Arizona by 0.3 points, and Wisconsin by 0.7 points. 4 years earlier, Hillary Clinton lost Michigan by 0.3 percentage points, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin by 0.7 points, and Florida by 1.2 points. The power of the presidency is regularly decided on the margins and may well hinge on that state assembly race that no one is paying attention to. Strategic hacks are now starting to look at filling the gaps on existing ballots this election year, not necessarily to win the races, but to build capacity, goodwill, and potential. It might be the smartest investment a party can make. The Coronavirus Brief by Jamie Ducharme, health correspondent. There's a photo here. It looks dark outside, not necessarily cold, but the people standing in a line are all bundled up against the cold. They've got slacks and blue jeans and insulated jackets and caps and masks. A lot of them have hands in their jacket pockets. There is a storefront behind them. Oh, it's about three stories high with scaffolding out front. It's out front on the lower level by the big windows. The caption reads, New Yorkers wait to get tested December 22 amid a surge of Omicron cases. Here's the text by Jamie Ducharme. In the early months of the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, breakthrough infections among the inoculated were so rare that individual cases sometimes made the news. Now, as Omicron tears through the U.S., that era is clearly over. Avoiding COVID-19 forever is an increasingly untenable strategy, several experts told me for a recent story. As highly contagious variants like Omicron move through our reopened world, breakthrough infections are becoming much more common. On an individual level, at least for most vaccinated people, that is not a reason to panic. Fully vaccinated people still have strong protection against severe disease and death, and boosted people are in an even better position. If you've had your shots, a breakthrough infection might make you feel lousy for a few days, but it is unlikely to threaten your life or land you in the hospital. For that reason, we may someday be as blasé about a breakthrough infection as we would be about a case of the flu or a bad cold. But someday is not today. Individual risks for vaccinated people might be low, but our societal situation is bad. Hospitals are understaffed and overwhelmed, and as Omicron pushes case counts to new heights, that situation will only get worse, to the detriment of anyone who needs emergency medical care for any reason. A huge chunk of our population is still vulnerable to the virus, too. Almost 40% of people in the U.S. are not fully vaccinated, including all children under 5 for whom there is not yet an authorized shot. And the elderly, those who are immunocompromised, and people with other underlying medical issues are still at a higher than average risk. To open the floodgates and let the virus run wild is to put all these lives in danger. Several experts told me we are at a transitional stage. We're close to treating breakthrough infections as routine, but not there yet. Our systems are too weak, and too much of our population is at high risk. For now, our priority has to be flattening the Omicron curve as much as possible. Only once the emergency passes and our nation's treatment and testing capabilities hopefully increase, can we begin to accept that COVID-19 is here to stay. Under politics, committee countdown. The House panel on January 6 races to conclude its work before the midterms by Nick Popley, P-O-P-L-I. There's a photograph here of two individuals, a male and a female, Select Committee Vice Chair Liz Cheney and Chairman Benny Thompson at a December 14 hearing. Mr. Thompson is wearing a blue suit, white shirt, and a blue and red striped tie. He looks mostly bald, but he has gray facial hair and wears glasses. Ms. Cheney is also wearing blue with a bright pink shirt beneath the jacket. She's wearing blue glasses, and her hair is blonde and approximately shoulder length. When a bipartisan House committee began investigating the January 6 insurrection, its goal was simple: compile a detailed account of what happened and make recommendations to ensure it never happens again. But piecing together the facts of how that day unfolded has proved to be a daunting task. So far, the Select Committee has obtained more than 30,000 records, interviewed over 300 witnesses, and issued subpoenas to dozens of former President Donald Trump's allies. Yet its work remains far from complete. Members of Trump's inner circle are refusing to cooperate with the investigation, and the committee's waiting to see whether the Supreme Court will deny the former president's request to block access to White House records related to the riot. Lacking crucial evidence, the 9-member House panel hopes to finish its work before the November 8 midterm elections, when Republicans could win back control of the House and dissolve the committee. What new evidence have they found? The biggest source of evidence uncovered by the panel is some 9,000 pages of documents that White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows turned over before he decided to stop cooperating. Among them are text messages to Meadows that have brought new focus on Trump's failure to act quickly to stop the insurrection, despite pleas from lawmakers, journalists, and even his eldest son. "Someone is going to get killed," one anonymous message warned Meadows. "He's got to condemn this SHT. ASAP," Donald Trump Jr. wrote. Investigators are also reviewing a PowerPoint presentation circulated by Phil Waldron, a retired colonel who worked with Trump's outside legal team, that recommended Trump declare a national emergency to keep himself president, and proposed Vice President Mike Pence reject electors from states where fraud occurred, despite there being no evidence of such fraud. What have they done? So far, the committee has subpoenaed around 50 Trump allies and rally organizers for documents, phone records, and bank statements. Most witnesses have cooperated, but three former Trump aides have refused to comply with the records request. Chief Strategist Stephen Bannon, Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark, and Meadows. The House voted to hold Bannon and Meadows in contempt of Congress, a misdemeanor criminal offense that can result in up to 1 year in prison. In December, the panel requested interviews with Republican representatives Scott Perry of Florida and Jim Jordan of Ohio, who reportedly communicated with Trump January 6. Investigators have also suggested subpoenaing Trump to answer questions before the committee. Experts warn he is unlikely to speak as long as the courts are considering his claims of executive privilege, a legal defense Trump is trying to use to shield his presidential communications despite no longer serving in office. What now? One of the most critical questions the panel will try to answer is whether Trump's conduct, while a mob of his supporters overtook the Capitol, could qualify as an effort to obstruct the certification of Joe Biden's victory and amount to criminal obstruction of Congress. We know hours passed with no action by the president to defend the Congress of the United States from an assault. While we were trying to count electoral votes, GOP Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming said to House colleagues December 14. While courts have held in the past that Congress cannot conduct a law enforcement investigation, lawmakers can share the results of their probe with the Justice Department if they believe they've uncovered evidence of a crime. Such a criminal referral could affect the midterms and increase pressure on Attorney General Merrick Garland to prosecute Trump and his allies for their role in the insurrection. But time is short. Committee Chairman Representative Benny Thompson, a Democrat from Mississippi, said he hopes to finish by early spring. "We will tell this story to the American people, but we won't do it piecemeal," he said December 13. "We'll do it when we can tell the story all at once from start to finish." Viewpoint, Embrace America by Defending the Rights of Others, by Ennis, or Enes, E-N-E-S, Cantor, Freedom. In my first weeks as a U.S. citizen, I've experienced the rich fullness and contradictions of what it means to be an American. I changed my last name to Freedom, and then made the most of that newfound freedom by continuing to advocate for the oppressed and speaking truth to power at every opportunity. Along the way, I made a point of expressing gratitude for the freedom U.S. citizens are entitled to. We're free to speak our minds and pursue our dreams and have the opportunity to forge our destiny. The freedom to engage in protest is precisely what makes this country so great, but I also understand this country was built on slavery and racial injustice, a legacy that lives on today. In the aftermath of George Floyd's murder, I was among the first in the NBA to march and speak in solidarity with our brothers and sisters fighting for overdue systemic change. In the U.S., we have the ability to engage in such protests to move our country forward. I come from a country, Turkey, where authorities tried to kidnap me, forced my family to publicly disown me, tortured my father in detention, and ultimately revoked my passport, stripping me of my home and my identity, all for speaking up for human rights. The very expression of dissent and participation in protest are met with violent suppression in authoritarian regimes around the world. In China, the regime is trying to erase Uyghurs and other ethnic minority groups in Xinjiang, has systematically abused the basic human rights of Tibetans, and suppressed the civil rights of Hong Kongers. That is why I use my platform to speak out and to offer my unique perspective on the immeasurable value and responsibility that come with our many freedoms here. But I do not speak from either the right or the left. As a human rights activist, I know we need to work across divides with all allies in the struggle for justice, regardless of political background. Like so many, I worry that my deeper message tends to get lost in the culture wars and polarization of today. I want us to lift one another up, make one another better. I have immense respect for LeBron James and his leadership in giving back and supporting progressive causes, but I called him out to raise awareness about his silence and that of too many others in the face of the Chinese Communist Party, CCP, and its economic clout. Instead, we must stand up against the CCP's domestic mass atrocities, including the forced labor industry behind the very shoes and clothes we wear and promote. There's a long list of celebrities, government officials, and corporations that prefer to stay silent on China to preserve their business deals. The CCP's economic influence comes at the expense of its victims. I wanted to sound the alarm on Nike's complicity in the CCP's attempted genocide against the Uyghurs because NBA players have the power to make a difference here. As of 2020, one of Nike's largest shoe factories, Taekwon, has been documented as forcing hundreds of Uyghurs, and that is spelled U-I-G-H-U-R-S, mostly women, to produce millions of Nike shoes annually. A new report further underscores the high risk of forced Uyghur labor within Nike's supply chain. The freedom in my last name is our greatest strength, something that is not guaranteed in many countries in the world. Let us tap into it and work together to make this country and world a better place. The U.S. has said it will not send its officials to the 2020 Beijing Olympics. We should continue putting pressure on corporate sponsors, including Visa, Alibaba, Allianz, Coca-Cola, Dow, General Electric, Intel, Panasonic, Procter & Gamble, Toyota, and Airbnb to follow suit and withdraw. We as athletes should further push our governments, the IOC and sporting associations, to move the games and suspend all other sporting activities hosted by a regime committing ongoing, widespread human rights abuses. Do we really want to risk sending our players to a country that disappears its own citizens and arbitrarily imprisons foreigners as bargaining chips? We should speak up for injustice around the world. We should embrace the promise of America. Freedom, the last name of this author, plays for the Boston Celtics. There's a photo here of his back. He's wearing white with the green edging of the Celtics players. Freedom is in bold print across his back, his shirt back, and number 13 is emblazoned beneath Freedom. The View, Work, How to Make a Return to the Office a Little Less Stressful, by Anne Helen Peterson, who is co-author of Out of Office, The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. Ever since vaccines became widely available to adults in the U.S., the conversation in HR departments and C-suites has centered on the same topic. How and when are we going to go back to the office? I have spent the past 21 months talking to companies, experts, and employees about the pitfalls and promising changes that can accompany the shift from fully remote or optional office time to at least some mandatory in-person time, and the best advice I can give is that it's going to feel messy, fraught, and unsatisfying for a while, but that does not mean there are not ways to address the feelings. For employers, number one, recognize that the future is flexibility. Companies determined to go back in time to pre-COVID-19 norms are in for a harsh reality. Flexibility might involve any number of combinations of remote and in-person work, but many people have no desire to return to the way things were. Either you're going to fight that tide and watch people leave, or start grappling with the future now. 2. Solicit feedback and listen to it. Asking for feedback and then ignoring it is a recipe for demoralization. If you're actually interested in cultivating a flexible work environment that serves the best interest of the company, keep actively listening to and acting on employee options. How are caretakers feeling? Parents of kids under 5? New employees? Have job descriptions changed? The more you think about back to the office as figuring out the future of flexible work for all of us, the more collaborative and satisfying the process will be. 3. Flexible management is a skill. Managing people's hard. Even before the pandemic, most managers had little training in how to do it well, and managing people within sight every day is a different skill from managing people remotely. Figure out how to provide the training and support that will make good, flexible management possible. Much of the pandemic was spent cultivating patience as we tried to wing it under compounding forms of duress. It is time to start figuring out sustainable systems for how we'll work moving forward, and that includes management. For workers, 1. Acknowledge the discomfort. We are not rubber bands that can just bounce back to our previous way of working, especially when going to an office comes with the stresses of a commute, childcare gaps, or the fear of COVID-19 exposure amid a rapidly spreading Omicron variant. Work with your manager to figure out how to not only acknowledge whatever distress arises, but also give yourself space to process it. That might include weekly check-ins and scheduled paid time off to let yourself absorb the changes. 2. Identify your rhythms. When are your deep work concentration hours? What's your best time and location for administrative work? Flexible work means the chance to craft your workday, at least in some form, around what works for you. You might have already been doing this to some extent during the pandemic, but reopening of offices offers a chance to revisit your schedule in a meaningful way. On the days you work from home, how can you create on and off ramps to ease in and out of the workday? How can you block spaces in your calendar for a lunch not spent in front of your computer? 3. Reserve the right to look elsewhere. How your company handles the transition back to the office is indicative of how it handles, well, everything. If people in charge ignore worker concerns, if guidelines feel arbitrary, there are many other organizations that are looking. No job's perfect, but some jobs, particularly at companies committed to figuring out a way forward in this new flexible reality, are far better than others. Here's time off the year ahead, the most anticipated TV shows of 2022 by Aliana Docterman. Peacemaker. The Suicide Squad director James Gunn spins off a series around John Cena's character who straddles the hero-villain divide. Up on January 13 on HBO Max, As We See It, Friday Night Lights and Parenthood producer Jason Katims brings a new drama to Amazon centered on three autistic 20-something roommates navigating work and love. January 21, Amazon. The Gilded Age, Downton Abbey creator Julian Fellowes' new drama is set in 1880s New York City, where old money families clash with newcomers amassing fortunes in railway, coal, and copper. January 24, HBO. Pam and Tommy. Lily James and Sebastian Stan star as Pamela Anderson and Tommy Lee, whose honeymoon sex tape became one of the first viral videos ever when released without their permission in 1995. February 2, on Hulu, Inventing Anna. Shonda Rhimes' latest dramatizes the true story of Anna Delvey, Julia Garner, a con woman who sneaked her way into New York high society until two high-profile magazine features exposed her grifting. February 11, Netflix. Pachinko. This multilingual adaptation of Min Jin Lee's novel is a saga of forbidden love that spans Korea, Japan, and the U.S. Spring on Apple TV+. The Lord of the Rings series, the most expensive season of television ever produced, with a budget of nearly $500 million. This prequel is set in Middle Earth, thousands of years before The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. September 2, Amazon. American Gigolo. John Bernthal stars in this present-day reimagining of Paul Schrader's 1980 film about the sex industry. To be announced, Showtime. Anatomy of a Scandal, Big Little Lies. David E. Kelley adapts this 2018 book, which traces the ripple effects of a rape accusation through the British elite. Sienna Miller, Michelle Dockery, and Rupert Friend star. To be announced, Netflix. Avatar, The Last Airbender. A beloved animated series gets a live-action adaptation starring Daniel Day-Kim, Ken Leung, and Kim's convenience patriarch, Paul Sung-hyung Lee. To be announced, Netflix. Brideshead Revisited. Call Me By Your Name's Luca Guadagnino adapts Evelyn Waugh's novel about a British man who gets entangled in an aristocratic family's drama. With Andrew Garfield, Rooney Mara, and Cate Blanchett. To be announced, BBC. House of the Dragon, the first Game of Thrones prequel, is set 200 years before the events of Thrones and centers on infighting within the Targaryen household. To be announced, HBO. The Last of Us, the morally complex video game about a hardened survivor, Pedro Pascal, tasked with ushering a girl across the U.S. during a zombie apocalypse, makes its way to TV, care of Chernobyl creator Craig Mazin. To be announced, HBO. Marvel shows. The TV expansion of the Marvel Cinematic Universe continues with Ms. Marvel, Moon Knight, She-Hulk, and Secret Invasion, bringing Oscar Isaac, Ethan Hawke, and Tatiana Maslany into the fold. To be announced, Disney Plus. The Old Man. Jeff Bridges plays a retired CIA agent living off the grid when an assassin arrives to try to take him out, forcing him to revisit his past. John Lithgow co-stars. To be announced, FX. The Staircase, a fictional version of the true crime doc of the same name, centers on Michael Peterson, Colin Firth, who was accused of murdering his wife, Toni Collette, in 2001. To be announced, HBO Max. Star Wars shows. This year will bring the long-awaited Obi-Wan Kenobi series starring Ewan McGregor and Rogue One prequel Andor with Diego Luna. To be announced, Disney Plus. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.